Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back once again to the National Press Club. My name is Richard Salmon. I'm a member of the Board of Governors here at the club, and I'm a reporter for Congressional Quarterly. I'd like to welcome club members and their guests in the audience today, as well as those of you who are watching today's events on C-SPAN or listening on National Public Radio. Before introducing our head table, I'll remind our members of some upcoming events. On April 29, the Dalai Lama of Tibet will be here to address the club on U.S.-China relations. On April 30, Robert Dole, the Senate Minority Leader, will be here to discuss President Clinton's first 100 days. On May 4, Christopher Patton, the Governor of Hong Kong, will discuss economic and political developments in Hong Kong. And on May 5, Mickey Cantor, the U.S. Trade Representative, will be here to address the club on the GATT and the NAFTA talks. Audio and videotapes of press club luncheons are available through the National Press Club Library or by dialing 1-800-952-TAPE. Our speaker today is a lawyer who tired of practicing traditional law, a scholar whose training comes from a non-traditional career path, and a writer whose 8 books and numerous articles have fascinated and irritated the scholarly world. If those seem the hallmark of a good journalist, perhaps it explains why Herschel Shanks is also a member in good standing of the National Press Club. He is founder and editor of the Biblical Archaeology Review, of Bible Review, and editor and publisher of Moment magazine. He has a Harvard Law degree, a Columbia graduate degree in sociology, and an undergraduate degree from Haverford. He did well on his SATs, too. He's here today to talk, among other things, about the Dead Sea Scrolls. That's the area where he's best known. In fact, it has been said that Herschel Shanks is to the Dead Sea Scrolls what Daniel Ellsberg was to the Pentagon Papers. He is the person most responsible for making the scrolls public, freeing them from the exclusive confines of a tiny group of traditional biblical scholars, where the scrolls had been since they were first discovered in the 1940s by a boy in a desert cave overlooking the Dead Sea. The uproar caused by Shanks' publication of 3 volumes of facsimiles of the scrolls still reverberates through the halls of academia and in the courts in Jerusalem. Just last month, an Israeli judge ruled that Shanks had violated the copyright of an Israeli scholar when he published a portion of the scrolls the scholar had reproduced. Arriving here today from the vortex of modern biblical conflict, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Herschel Shanks.
He stole some of my best lines. In early 1947, February, as close as we can tell, a pair of Bedouin shepherds were searching for some lost sheep on the northwestern shore of the Dead Sea. And they came upon a cave that looked a little tight to squeeze into. So they, instead of climbing in, they took a rock and threw it into the cave, anticipating or hoping that some bleeding sheep would come out. But instead of bleeding sheep, they heard the sound of cracking pottery. The next day, they squirmed into the cave, and there they found some ancient jars. And inside the ancient jars were some packages wrapped in linen. And inside the linen, as they failed to recognize at the time, were some ancient scrolls, 7 of them, including the earliest copy ever discovered of the entire book of Isaiah in Hebrew. Eventually, they took their finds to the Bedouin market in Bethlehem and negotiated badly, as almost everyone does with the antiquities merchants there. And the seven scrolls got parceled out into two packs. The first pack of three finally got into the hands of a Hebrew University professor. And I think you have to remember at this time, 1948 we're into now, the last days of the British mandate over Palestine, there was violence, ill feeling, danger, imminent war. Sections of the city were divided by barbed wire. And an Armenian friend of a Jewish professor at Hebrew University brought to this Jewish professor by the name of Eliezer Sukenik, brought him a scrap from one of the scrolls that the Bedouin had discovered, and he passed it through to Sukenik through the barbed wire. And Sukenik was the first to realize what, in fact, these were. And he wanted to go to Bethlehem to buy them. Bethlehem was in the Arab area. And he would have to go through the barbed wire. And there was some danger. He asked his son whether it would be all right to go. His son was head of the operations of the Haganah, the pre-state Israel army. His son had taken a Hebrew name. His name was Yigal Yadin, who was to become Israel's most illustrious biblical archaeologist. Yadin told the father it was too dangerous, don't go. And he said, beside, you don't have the money. Sukenik mortgaged his home, disobeyed his son, and took an Arab bus to Bethlehem. Was treated fine, no problem, negotiated for the purchase of the three scrolls, and he came home with them in brown wrapping, riding again in an Arab bus and without incident. Thus, the first three scrolls were acquired by Israel. Within that same 24-hour period that Sukenik acquired those scrolls, I say for Israel, in that 24-hour period, whether by some divine hand or providence or luck or whatever, the United Nations passed by a two-thirds resolution, the resolution that created the renewed, revived state of Israel for the first time in 2,000 years. So these two events, almost messianic, came together at a single day in history. The other four scrolls got into the hands of an Assyrian cleric by the name of the Metropolitan Samuel. And Samuel attempted to sell them, and he was, by this time, he had some idea of their value, and it was he couldn't get his price in Jerusalem. So he decided that he would take them to the United States, and that's what he did. But even here, he couldn't get his price. Ironically, the reason was that Jordan had made a claim to title. And everybody was afraid of not being able to get good title of these things. So in this ironic sense, Jordan, as we shall see, helped Israel to acquire them. When the Metropolitan Samuel could not get his price, in desperation, he finally decided that he would put a classified ad in, of all places, the Wall Street Journal. And I don't mean to derogate my colleagues on the Wall Street Journal, but one doesn't think of the Wall Street Journal as the place to sell Dead Sea Scrolls. But as luck would have it, or whatever, if it's not luck, Yigal Yadin was in the country when this ad appeared. And someone advised Yadin, said, did you see this ad? And Yadin immediately knew what they were. He knew that the Metropolitan Samuel wouldn't sell it to an Israeli. So he, through fronts, negotiated. And it's still a question. Did the Metropolitan Samuel know that it was really going to Israel, because the truth of the matter is it was purchased for a song, $250,000 for four intact Dead Sea Scrolls. Perhaps he knew, perhaps he had to put on a front himself. But at any rate, Yadin purchased the scrolls through front. They went back to Israel. Israel built a special museum for them, the Shrine of the Book, and that's where these seven scrolls are still housed today. That's just the beginning of the story. That's the easy part. When this cave where the scrolls were discovered was identified and confirmed by archaeologists, because they found some other scraps there. They found pottery similar to the pottery that was originally taken out there. So they confirmed the location. At that point, there became a mad scramble to find other caves. As a matter of fact, the Tamira Bedouin, who were the original finders, they gave up shepherding. They became archaeologists. And their competition was the professionals. And as you might expect, the Bedouin almost always won. They knew the thousands of caves so much better. And in the next decade, after the discovery of these first seven, 10 additional caves were located with inscriptional material. A total of over 800 scrolls were found in this period. So that when we are talking about the Dead Sea Scrolls, we are talking about an entire library. 800 books in the ancient world is extraordinary, an extraordinary collection. But the flip side of that extraordinary fact is that except for about a dozen of these scrolls, they are all in little pieces with 90% of them missing, sometimes more. You have just little scraps. So that there's a tremendous problem of putting them together. The mother lode was found, and the caves were numbered from 1 to 11, and the mother lode was found in cave 4. Cave 4 had over 500 scrolls in it. Not a single one was intact, and none had more than a small percentage of it left. The estimates of the number of fragments in this cave vary from about 15,000 to 100,000. And the Bedouin found this. It's a mystery still today. How did the Bedouin find it when it is right adjacent to the famous settlement at Qumran, where the scholars and the professional archaeologists were digging? Right under their nose, the Bedouin were extracting all these little fragments. And finally, and the professionals had done a survey of the area. Instead of looking in the Marl Terrace below the settlement at Qumran, they were looking up in the caves, the limestone cliffs above. The Bedouin weren't so dumb. Finally, after the cave had been excavated about 80%, the professionals noticed, hey, these Bedouin are going in and out of some place down there. What the hell's going on down there? And they examined and they found out that what was going on. Indeed, they kicked the Bedouin out, finished the excavation, but 80% of it was in the hands of the Bedouin. Now, this created a tremendous problem, because if these fragments got into the hands of various antiquities dealers, and the antiquities dealers then sold it to a variety of purchasers, you would never get the collection back together to try to put these 15 or 25 or 50,000 pieces together. The scholars immediately recognized this, and to deal with this, they made a deal with the Bedouin. For every centimeter of script, they would be paid one Jordanian dinar, which was then pegged to the English pound, $2.60. And that's how all these scraps were collected in one place, then the Palestine Archaeological Museum, now the Rockefeller Museum in Jerusalem. Under Jordanian auspices, a team of about 7 or 8 scholars were assembled to deal with these documents, to put them together and edit them and publish them. There were no Jews on the team, although these were virtually all Jewish religious documents. The team stumbled, and after two generations, managed to complete 25% of their work. It is difficult. I cannot convey to you how difficult this work is. The excavation and then putting the pieces together and trying to read these little things and make any sense out of them. So I have a certain compassion for the passage of time, even as much as it is, although two generations is still too much. But the indefensible position that they took was that in the meantime, other scholars couldn't see them. And that became the basis of a crusade, if you want to call it, in the Biblical Archaeology Review, which aroused worldwide opinion and finally led to a Pentagon Papers type of expose from a still unidentified source. We received photographs of the unpublished fragments. The large scrolls were published rather promptly by Israeli and American scholars, but the fragments from Cave 4 were not. And with that publication, everything changed. I think that the Israel Antiquities Authority has changed its attitude. They're publishing their own microfiche of these fragments now, and I would say we're working together. There's a team of nearly 70 scholars officially who have been assigned to get this material out in a couple of years, and in the meantime, any scholar who wishes can have access to the photographs and work on them. They're very difficult to work on. It's not easy. I want to talk a little about the what's in these scrolls. About 25%, let's say roughly 200, are biblical scrolls. They contain, in the whole collection, we find every book of the Hebrew Bible except the book of Esther. And the book of Esther, incidentally, is the only book of the Hebrew Bible which does not contain the name of God. Prior to this find, the oldest significant copy of the Hebrew Bible that we had was from about 1,000. This takes it back an entire millennium. We never expected to be able to trace the development of the Hebrew Bible with this kind of material. And it comes from a time before the text was standardized and before it was canonized. So sometimes we get different editions of the same book. We occasionally find a paragraph even that fell out of the Hebrew Bible. And we can trace how the canonical Bible was developed and processed and frequently come up with better readings. On the other hand, by and large, we are also finding that the transmission of the biblical text has been remarkably accurate and stable over the period. In addition to the biblical text, we have all kinds of hymns, psalms, liturgy, an important letter, which was involved in the lawsuit, which I lost a couple of weeks ago. A copper scroll, which we could spend an entire talk on. Apocryphal books, sometime in the original Hebrew, which we only had in Ethiopic or Greek. Pseudepigrapha, that is late books which were ascribed to ancient worthies like Noah or Moses, or the testaments of the 12 patriarchs. So we have this whole collection of religious writings and a special kind that seems to reflect a particular religious community. Scholars are arguing about whether this was the Essene community. It probably is, but there's some argument about that. Now, a few words about the significance of the scrolls. What are we learning about the scrolls? I think we can say the scrolls have a great deal to teach us in four areas. One I've already covered. I've talked about its importance for our understanding of the process by which the biblical text became standardized and canonized. The second area is the direct light it sheds on what we call Second Temple Judaism. In 70 AD, the Romans destroyed Jerusalem and burnt the temple. Before that date, there were a wide variety of Judaisms, much more varied than we have today. After 70, after that critical date, we have rabbinic Judaism. Before that date, we have a variety that scholars are now talking about Judaisms in the Second Temple period. So we learn so much more about the religious environment than we ever did before. After the destruction, we see the survival of only one form of Judaism, namely what we call rabbinic Judaism, and all branches of Judaism today are descendants of rabbinic Judaism. Out of this soil of Second Temple Judaism emerged two great Western religions, and those are the other two subjects that we get a great deal of light from the Dead Sea Scrolls. The first of these great religions is, as I've indicated, rabbinic Judaism. Up until now, it's been hard to discover the roots and how rabbinic Judaism developed in the pre-70 period. Now we can see how some of the Jewish liturgies predate 70. We can see some of the history that accounts for the development and survival of rabbinic Judaism and such matters as that. The second great religion that emerged out of Second Temple Judaism is Christianity. And the scrolls date from about 250 BC to 68 AD when the Romans destroyed the settlement on their way to Jerusalem. And this, of course, was the very period when Jesus of Nazareth walked this earth. There are many similarities between the doctrines of the community at Qumran and Christianity, and many differences, too. But it was out of this same milieu that Christianity developed. And we used to say that Christianity was a daughter religion of Israel, of Judaism. Now scholars are beginning to talk about them as siblings because they both emerged out of the same soil, but each emphasized different strands in that Second Temple Jewish milieu. The Christianity emphasized the apocalyptic, the end of days, salvation. Judaism emphasized the ethical, the legal, the practical day-to-day way of life. And not that they were exclusive, there was overlapping, but this was the kind of emphasis, and Christianity is heir to some of those strands and Judaism to others. In terms of the development of Christianity, I think that it's a wonderful topic. It's very hot. It's somewhat controversial. I think it's fair to say that the consensus of scholars is that the scrolls have revealed that Christianity, early Christianity, is much more deeply rooted in Judaism than anyone before contended. And secondly, that some of the ideas and concepts and rituals of early Christianity that were once thought to be unique are not so regarded today. We have Beatitudes at Qumran, we have communal meals, we have references to the Son of God, the Son of Man. So this all provides a background to the development of early Christianity. Does this undermine faith? I think not. When people ask me this, I sometimes say that if a scrap of leather from 2,000 years is going to undermine your faith, you have a pretty shaky faith. On the contrary, I think it enriches our understanding. No one contends that Jesus evolved in a vacuum. He lived on this earth in a particular cultural milieu, and anything that gives us a greater light on that background illuminates the significance of his life and of his crucifixion. Beyond that, I will close with the words of the great Jewish sage Hillel, "Now go and study." Thank you.